Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening. Tom Moran here from Tom's Big Spider. So as you've probably seen by the topic here, this one's going to get a little bit theoretical. And I want to explain off the bat that this is a topic that I have given a lot of thought to over the years, and something that it took me a while. It was an evolution in my own thinking, because as we'll point out when we get into the meat of this one, I held some ideas to be true that after I started thinking about them, after, you know, years, we're on a decade of keeping tarantulas, working with many people that keep tarantulas, I have a pretty unique perspective, so to speak, in that I have kept tarantulas. I got my first tarantulas back in the 90s, and I want to make it very, very clear, I'm not one of these people trying to pretend like I've been in the hobby since that time. I was not a tarantula person. I had reptiles. However, I did a lot of research in tarantulas. I'm still looking for somewhere. I have these crummy care sheets that I got when I went to a pet store and was looking at tarantulas and stuff. So I've kind of seen the care of our tarantulas evolve over the course of that time. And so I can look back at how we used to keep them, how we're keeping them now, which species were more popular then, or which species were around then, which species were introduced over the course of those years. Obviously, there was a gap there where I wasn't following the hobby, and I was shocked to see how many new species there were. But I think it allowed me to kind of look at this, take a step back, and go, what's happened to tarantulas after this many decades in captivity? Now, when did the actual tarantula hobby, so to speak, start? I don't know. It looks like they started selling them. It became more popular at pet stores and stuff in the 70s. It looks like late 70s, 80s. You'd get your, you know, Chilean Rose, which was a super popular tarantula back in time, only because they were just pulling them out of the wild as adult females. People were picking them up. And then the hobby built, you know, obviously, B. Smithy or Brachypelma Smithy was one that was very popular for a while and very, you know, widely available. But you started to see the hobby even at the 90s when I went in. You started seeing more of the, you know, old worlds come in, some unique species that you hadn't seen before. Now, this time period, we weren't actively breeding these. And I think this is going to be important for what we're about to get into. At this time period, the majority of tarantulas, I'd venture to say, were pulled out of the wild, wild caught specimens. People would go into the wild, they'd pull them out as adults, they'd pack them up, they'd send them over to the US or Europe or wherever they'd go, and they would be sold into the pet trade. So these are animals that are wild animals, so to speak. They were pulled from the wild, they were living in the wild, they had fought, they had gone through all types of adversity from little slings on to grow into big adults. They talk about survival of the fittest. These guys were the fittest specimens out there. And we plucked them out of the wild and we stuck them in a terrarium or a fish tank with a couple, you know, inches of sand or whatever crappy substrate we were using at the time. And we displayed them as pets. So I think it's important for us to start off this discussion by recognizing that the hobby back in the 70s, 80s, early 90s, up until, I would say, into probably late 90s, 2000, where there was a lot more, I think a lot of the captive, I could be wrong with this one, but I believe a lot of the captive bred breeding was in Germany. They were kind of pioneers of getting these guys and saying, you know, we're not just going to take them and sell them. We're going to grab pairs of them and breed them and produce slings. So now we have, during that time period, the evolution of the hobby where we're realizing we're not going to keep pulling these things out of the wild. We're going to get ourselves a few sets of males and females. We're going to try to breed them, pair them, get the babies, raise these babies up, and sell these babies into the hobby. And then that way we're going to keep things going, because we can't, it's not sustainable to pull animals out of the wild. You know, we can get into the wild caught thing later on in a different podcast. And I've discussed it before. I'd like to see us get to a point in the hobby where we're producing more of our own stuff. So I think that was one of the big, as the hobby became more popular, there's money in it. What are people going to do when there's money involved? They're going to get that money. They're going to breed these spiders. They're going to get them out there. As it picked up more steam, you have more species being pulled out of the wild. And this continues to happen. I want to make that very clear. We'd be kidding ourselves to believe that all of the spiders that are currently being sold in the hobby right now are captive bred specimens. It's just not true. I know US, I think Europe, you know, UK, all, I think a lot of us get the captive bred slings. However, I do think there are a lot of countries out there where they're still pulling in, and not to say they don't make their way to Europe, not to say they don't make their way to the US. I've seen pet stores here selling things like, not that long ago, a pet store came up with a bunch of Afanopelma simoni. and they were obviously wild-caught specimens. However, I think a lot of places now, the majority of them are captive raised. And think of some of the species that we have out there. Formictimus conceratus, I've seen, you know, people talk about having them in the 80s. Obviously, the rose hair, the B. smithii, the L. parahibana. There's so many species that have been in the hobby for so long that haven't been pulled out of the wild that we've been breeding and captive breeding. So I think to start this one off, we have to make we have to look at the fact that we have been breeding some of these species in captivity for decades, That's a long time. And as you're going to see in a moment when we get into this, it doesn't take long for humans to put their stamp on a certain animal, a species, a genus, a family, whatever it may be. Once we start meddling with stuff, we can change it. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. So when we talk about domestication, I have been guilty of this before. I have said to people before, they're not pets. They're not domesticated animals. They're wild animals. And unfortunately, I would love to be able to retract that statement, because I do feel like, obviously, as we mentioned earlier, the majority of ones coming into the hobby now are captive bred. However, we have to point out that there are still, anytime a new species is discovered, what happens? Somebody goes down there, they collect a bunch of wild-caught specimens. Usually nowadays, they're not selling the majority of those wild-caught specimens into the trade. They're going to try to breed them to produce more. But there are some, when new species come into play, you can assume there are some wild-caught specimens out there. However, for years, I've been referring to them as wild animals, and I don't really think the majority of the ones that we have in our collections really fit that bill anymore. So let's talk about domestication. I think I was guilty of this as well. When I hear a domesticated animal, what do you immediately think of? If you're like me, you're thinking of your go-to dogs and cats. Domesticated animals that have had thousands of years with humans. We have raised them. We've bred them. We've bred dogs to the point where we have mutants, where they have all kinds of impairments, but we think they're cute. So we continue to breed them into the pet trade. We have long ago, we took the wolf and the humans put our stamp on that animal. We created another whole animal out of it. And then we create all these breeds. Obviously, that is a domesticated animal. What do we think of when we say domesticated? I think the majority of us, if you said, what's another word for domestication, they would say tame. That's where I would kind of go with this. That's where my mind would immediately wander to if somebody said, what do you think domesticated means? I'd be like, a tamed down animal, one that we've had in captivity, you know, cows, horses, whatever it may be. It's ones that humans have worked with for quite some time, and we've changed, we've bred them, we've specifically picked traits that make them like people more so that we can work with them, and that's a domesticated animal. However, I saw an article that was talking about inadvertent domestication that got me kind of researching more of what is the scientific definition of domestication. And I was actually kind of surprised at what I found. This is one of these ones where you go down a rabbit hole, and this started a while ago, and I've been continuing to go down the rabbit hole because it fascinates the heck out of me. So what is domestication? Well, trying to find a solid scientific definition of this was very difficult because apparently this is a very hot topic in the scientific community. And I do hope, this is one of those ones I'm putting my neck out there because I am not a scientist. I do not have a background in biology. I consider myself a logical person. I love reading about biology. I love reading about this stuff. I love reading scientific papers. But at the end of the day, I do not work in this community. So this is something I would love to hear people chime in on as well. I don't want this to be Tom Moran's coming up with these crazy theories and throwing them out there as if they're true. They're not true. They're not proven. Again, this is a theory that I'm about to go through and something that I'm hoping other people will chime in. Maybe between all of us, we can come up with kind of an agreement here. But the issue with finding a definition for this is the fact that there appear to be many definitions for it. It's a hotly contested topic in the scientific community. The one that we're going to be using today, after looking at a bunch of them, comes from an article, What is Domestication, by Michael D. Peruginen. And it was in Science Direct, and I read a bunch of them, but this guy seemed to take a bunch of them and put them together, and this is the one we're going to use. So are there other definitions out there? Yes, but this one I like because it pulls a bunch of the key factors of all the different definitions floating around. So the core nature of domestication is essentially the co-evolution between the domesticator and the domesticate. So the domesticator, obviously what we'll be talking about today, is human beings. And the domesticate that we'll be getting into in a moment is obviously tarantulas. So I'm going to share the definition he has in here. In crafting a definition of domestication, the thoughtful analysis provided by Zeter, whose own definition leaves heavily on ideas by Rindos and others, can serve as a starting point. Synthesizing these and other perspectives, a broad biological definition of domestication is that it is the co-evolutionary process that arises from a mutualism in which one species, the domesticator, in this case we're talking about human beings, constructs an environment where it largely manages both the survival and reproduction of another species, the domesticate, in order to provide the former with resources and/or services. So let's fill in the blanks here. We have the domesticator, which is obviously human beings. Do we construct an environment for our spiders? We have been doing it for decades. Do we actively manage the survival and reproduction of these species, the domesticate, the tarantulas, in order to provide the former, that would be us, with resources and or services? Well, the services in this case would be the pet trade. We're going to make, well, some of us are going to keep them as pets because we love them or fascinated, but keep in mind there's always money behind this. So what are the services? We're going to sell these animals. We're going to produce these animals. We're going to sell these animals and make money for them. So I think this is, when I read this, it kind of blew my mind a bit because it fits. Now, I'm going to say it right off the bat, because anytime you do something like this, you run the risk of somebody blowing up, well, this is all in your head. Yes, this is what a theory is. This is after doing some research, using my brain, doing more research, letting it bounce around in my head for a while, considering the hobby over the last 10 years that I've been actively in, considering what I know before, and realizing this is a domesticated situation. This is an animal that has spent time where, think about it. I mean, this is fits perfectly. One species manages both the survival and reproduction of another species. That's what we're doing, folks. That's what we've been doing for decades. Now, this goes on to say, this allows for increased fitness for the interacting organisms within the mutual relationship, leading to the evolution of traits that ensures the stable association of domesticator and domesticate across generations. Now, has this been going on for generations? It absolutely has. We've had many, many species of spiders that have been around for at least 40 years, some of them 50 years, and many of them have been captive bred for decades. Now, what type of evolution or evolutionary traits might ensure the stable association of domesticated the humans and the tarantulas? Well, that's, I think, a very interesting question. Have we somehow changed these animals to be more adaptable to captivity? Have they changed any patterns? Are there physiological changes? Now, before people bristle and go, how the heck could an animal evolve over that short period of time? That's the thing that I have struggled with before, and you've heard it. If you go listen to older podcasts, you'll hear me reference at one point that I find it very surprising that a certain animal with only over 10 years would evolve its behavior and just because of human captivity. Well, boy, was I wrong, because it doesn't take that long at all for us to start impacting them, and sometimes in a physiological manner. So there was another article I stumbled across. It was, I believe, 2 years ago, and I've kind of had it on the back burner, and I wanted to do more research about it. But the article was about how captive rearing can accidentally or inadvertently change animals so they may not survive in the wild. It's accidental or inadvertent domestication. And basically what happened was, these are folks that are specifically raising animals to be released back in the wild. They're not trying to tame them down. They're not trying to put them in a zoo. They're not trying to get them used to human interaction. None of that. They are specifically trying to produce animals with the sole intent of reintroducing them into the wild. And what happened is, they noticed changes in the animals that were raised in captivity for the purpose of being redistributed into the wild. So the article states that there is a problem with this strategy to raise these animals and reintroduce them into the wild, because captive animals can inadvertently become domesticated temporarily or even permanently adapted to a captive environment, making them less fit to survive in the wild when they are reintroduced. And they go on to quote, Gabriella Mastromonaco states, definitely in the last 10 years, there was this change in thought process where those of us in the captive breeding world were better understanding the change in our animals. So they recognize that even though the whole point of this was to get the animals back in the wild, minimal human contact, they were seeing differences. And this, one of the big things they saw it with salmon that they were raising to release, they state, because we've removed some of the natural selection pressures, and whether that is a mate choice, sperm selection, and other factors, the overall fitness of the next generation are, in a sense, impacted whether we meant to or not. And this goes beyond just their behaviors. They found that there were actual physiological changes in some of these animals that we were raising in captivity to release in the wild. They were talking about morphological changes, changes in fat layers under the skin, changes in morphology, etc. That's crazy stuff. So these are animals that we are not raising to be pets. These are animals, and again, I know somebody will probably jump in and go, well, we're talking about fish here. Well, they're talking about other animals as well. They were talking about some of the big cats they were raising. This is a problem across the board with animals that humans are trying to, like, hey, you know what, we're going to try to raise them in captivity, put them back in the wild. We are fundamentally changing them. They are adapting whether we mean to, mean for them to or not. They are adapting to a life in captivity. Their bodies are changing. They're evolving in this short period of time because of the fact that we are selecting which ones go on. We are selecting which animals mate. We are selecting which animals go into the wild. We are taking natural selection out of the process. So that's some pretty heavy stuff. And that's something that you look at and you go, wow, you know, that's kind of neat. But then you start bringing it back to tarantulas, which unfortunately, not only is there a lack of real study of tarantulas in the wild, and I did try to find some studies about this. So if anybody knows of them, Luis, if you're out there, buddy, I'd love to hear if you know any articles that pertain to this, but I don't think anybody's actually studied this as far as, you know, wild caught or wild specimens of tarantulas versus the ones that have been in the hobby for a while. I would love, you know, I'm going to have some recommendations at the end of things I would love to see, but that would kind of blow my mind a bit to see how maybe we have altered these animals, because I think we have a problem with you as humans, and I've been guilty of this as well, where we don't recognize our impact on nature sometimes. We're naive. We don't see how much of an impact we have on the natural world and on the animals around us. And I believe this is particularly evident when we talk about our impact on tarantulas and how they might have changed after decades of captivity. We always do care guides and we talk about their natural, you know, where they came from. And I have no way, shape, or form advocating that people stop looking up the species, where they came from, how they live. I think that's all incredibly important information. But I do think it's high time that we have a talk and recognize the fact that the spiders that we are currently keeping in our rooms are far from wild animals. These are probably not, in many cases, especially the ones that have been in the hobby a long time. If you could impact some, you know, salmon that you're raising for a bit, imagine these spiders that we've been doing for decades, dropping them off in the wild. These guys have been in human captivity for so long, you almost have to concede that there have to have been some changes in them. So let's take a look at tarantulas. Let's shift this and look at tarantulas in general. Let's think about natural selection. In the wild, many tarantulas have hundreds of slings because there are only a handful of the strongest are meant to make it. There are ones that, you know, if you raise slings ever, they get to be a certain point where they molt out the second instar, they start feeding, and guess who they start feeding on first? They start feeding on their sac mates, the slow ones, the ones that might be a little deformed. They're going to start culling their own numbers. It's survival of the fittest, folks. So we're going to do a battle royale. Only the strongest ones are going to survive and move out into the wild. Now, imagine that in the wild, the ones that don't get eaten, out of that fraction of the ones that don't get eaten, those go into the wild. Think of how many of them never make it through a year. They either die because of the conditions. They die because even after they eat their sac mates, they're just too weak to live. They're predated on by other animals. There's so many things that could kill these young spiders in the wild, which again is why they have hundreds. In some cases, look at the Lasiodora parahibana, thousands of them. And now think about this. In captivity, this doesn't happen. Right off the bat, we are putting our human stamp on these animals. And the way I see it, we're putting a sharp line in between wild and captive, wild and quote unquote domesticated, because that first batch of slings we produced, that's where we are meddling in genetics. We are meddling in the ability of natural selection to take its course and, for lack of a better term, eliminate some of these weaker animals. Because what happens when we raise a sac? We pull it from the mom, 30-something days, we pull the sac, we open it up when there's eggs for legs, we let them, we create a perfect environment in there. There's going to be no drought that kills them, no maybe really hot day, no cold snap. There, we're going to have an environment that is obviously conducive to them reproducing and growing. They're going to come out, they're going to go into second instar, and what do we do when they hit second instar? We separate them as quickly as possible. I think back to when I raised the sac of Orphanacus philippinus slings. And I remember turning to Billy going, I'm shocked at the difference in sizes of these slings. There were some decent sized ones, like close to a half an inch, and then there were some tiny ones. And we realized, you know, when you look back at it, would those tiny ones have survived? Probably not. They probably would have been lunch for the bigger ones. And that's the natural order of things. But we took that out of the equation. We immediately separated them, sent them off, people got them. In our homes, do they do okay? Yes, but we're talking about specimens that would not have been fit to survive in the wild, and we allowed them to reproduce. We allowed them to survive. We gave everything to them. Remember in that definition, we talk about the fact that humans control the breeding, they control the resources. Do we control breeding and resources with our captive bred spiders? We sure as heck do. We find males, we pair them, we protect them, we feed them, they get fed constantly. In the wild, some of these spiders can probably go weeks without finding a good meal. Mine, they molt, they get a big old fat roach right off the bat to fatten up. They get regular prey items delivered to them. We are controlling everything for these guys. We are allowing many of them, thousands of them, through the course of the hobby, millions of them that would not have survived in nature. We have not only allowed to survive, but in many cases they grow up, and what do? We pair them. We breed them. So those genes, whatever that was that should have been knocked off, was now allowed to continue. In this instance, we are talking about human selection as opposed to natural selection. More inferior stock is surviving due to human, we'll call it, interference. We separate the slings, we eliminate the predation, we keep them from, you know, eating their sac mates. There's no predators, there's no bad weather, there's no droughts, etc. They're all allowed to live. Now, here's my question to you folks out there. Now, I pose this to you. When they first started, a lot of times the first species get in hobby, sometimes they find females are already gravid, ready to have egg sacs. And sometimes they find, what, you know, they do captive breeding with a wild-caught pair, whatever it may be. But imagine you pull a spider out of the wild and it lays an egg sac. So technically you're not having a captive bred spider, you're having a captive hatched group of slings. Is it so inconceivable that the first batches of those slings that survive, because a lot of times you hear early on when they do a breeding of slings or of new species, they have a hard time producing them. Sometimes it's difficult to get them to mate. Sometimes they don't get a lot of them to survive. But is it so inconceivable that the slings that survive might not have been the most hardy for their natural environment, but instead were better adapted to captive life? So we're talking lower temperatures, lack of seasons, lower moisture, whatever it may be. So is it also so inconceivable that there have been physiological changes in these animals that have been captively raised for years? And think of some of the things that could have changed on them. We were talking about the thickening of the cuticles that prevent dehydration. I can think of so many species of tarantulas that when they first came in the hobby, we said these are moisture dependent. They need moist substrate. They need moisture at all times, spray down, water dish. And now a lot of folks are keeping them on the drier side and they do just fine. Is it possible that some of them have developed ways to regulate when they respirate? When they respirate, I don't know if folks know this, but a lot of moisture is lost through their book lungs. So the hotter it gets, the more they respirate, the more they're going to amp up their respiration, the more potential moisture is going to be lost, which is why they can get more dehydrated when it's hotter. Is there a way that maybe some of these specimens that came out were just better at doing this? Hence why they're not so moisture dependent anymore. I don't know. And I want to make this, I'm going to say this repeatedly throughout this because, I have a problem with people sometimes taking little sections of my podcast and using just ones that fit their narrative and not offering the full explanation. I am not saying this is fact. This is purely conjecture. I think it makes a lot of sense. I think it's a pretty solid theory. But have our spiders evolved over the course of decades to be a better fit for life in captivity? We have provided them with food. We've provided them with a safe environment. We don't. It's why I love getting in the discussions with people who say things like they don't have water dishes in nature. You gotta give them heat during the day because they have that in nature. You're not keeping them on the correct substrate, all this stuff. And I'm not going to argue that it doesn't. I want to make it very, very clear. As the years have gone on, I've tried to give my tarantulas, adult tarantulas, more naturalistic environments, but we are not dealing with wild animals in most cases. These are not animals. If somebody handed me a tarantula and said, listen, this one is just plucked out of, I don't know, Thailand, and you need to set it up correctly. Am I going to be a lot more careful with the trying to mimic its natural environment? Yes, because this is an animal that was ripped out of its natural environment. It hasn't had any interaction with man before that. It hasn't had decades of captive breeding to kind of change its morphology or its resistance to different things. Yes, I'm going to try to hit that. But as far as these captive bred ones that we've had for years, we've even got examples of people trying to emulate where they came from, and it fails miserably. So, for example, the Carabina versicolor, which back in the day was the Avicularia versicolor. We're still struggling with this one. People read they're up in trees. They come from very humid environments. We stick them in little vials. We stick them in enclosures. They weren't very well ventilated for us. We give them moist substrate. We give them water dishes. We spray the snot out of them, and they die. They die with stuffy enclosures. The majority of us that raise them now and know how to raise Avicularia species or Carabina versicolors, Carabina species, recognize that the key is to keep them dry with good ventilation and a water dish. That's all it takes. But us, through humans trying to emulate that natural process, we realize it doesn't necessarily work. C. cyanopubescens, another one. They originally, when those came in the hobby, I've talked about this before. Luckily, I haven't seen any of these old care sheets in quite some time. But when we first pulled them out of the wild, we realized that, oh, they come from a very humid area. So everybody was keeping them very humid. It makes sense. When you have slings, especially, you want to keep them humid. They were dropping like flies. I remember reading an old post, I think it might have been on arachnoboards, where people were like, I don't know why these things don't stay alive. They were having a real tough time. But well, then all of a sudden, people started keeping them dry with a water dish, sprinkling a little water on the webbing. You know, at evening, they did perfectly fine. So trying to emulate the nature sometimes backfires. And then look at ones that have been in the hobby for quite some time. Let's take a look at Theraphosa, for example, if we're talking about how we might have impacted these. First Theraphosa were coming over, obviously mostly wild caught. People were struggling to keep them alive. They were dropping dead. When they were difficult to breed, we weren't getting a lot of slings. We got slings. There was a high mortality rate. Nowadays, they're very readily available. There's a lot of breeding of them going on, successful pairing of breeding of them. And a lot of folks keep them and aren't having the difficulties we had a decade ago. Why is that? Did we just get better in our husbandry? I don't think so. I think in this case, we have spiders that seem to be much more hardy in captivity. They seem to, and think about it. We talk about that domestication definition. We are determining which ones breed, which ones grow to adulthood. We provide everything for them. Is it so strange to think, is it so unbelievable to think that over that time period through us doing this, we've triggered something in these spiders that makes them adapt more to captivity? What would happen if we took these guys and dumped them back outside? I don't know. Spiders are very, very, not just tarantulas, spiders in general, incredibly hardy and resilient and adaptable animals. So maybe you put them back in the wild, they do perfectly fine. However, that adaptability does go both ways. And I think that's what we miss. This is not a one-way door. Adaptability means you go into another situation and you adapt and you thrive. And I think if anything I've seen with tarantulas over decade of keeping them is that they are very adaptable and they don't just survive. They don't just tolerate different conditions. They thrive in it. They eat, they grow, they burrow, they web, they reproduce, they have babies. The babies grow up. Think about it, guys. Decades of doing this. Are you going to try to tell me that some of these guys aren't better adapted for captivity than their original wild-caught ancestors? I just don't think it's possible. Now, let's go back to our definition of domestication. One of the things people talk about when they talk about domestication is changes in temperament, changes in behavior. So let's take a look at some of the spiders that we have kept that we've seen changes in behavior over the years. So one that readily comes to mind is the Afanopelma simoni. When I first got my Efanopelma simoni, the male I ended up having in the 90s, they were a burrowing species. Everything you read about him said, this is a species that needs a burrow. Mine absolutely burrowed, stayed in the burrow, came out until he got his little emboli, went out trying to find a lady. This was considered to be how this species acted. They were definitely a fossorial spider. However, after years of being in the hobby, every time I do something on a Efanopelma simoni, I have folks who go, yeah, mine's totally terrestrial. It doesn't burrow. And I get that a lot. And then I ask them, did you buy yours as a sling or did you buy it as a young adult? Was it wild caught? Was it captive bred? And the majority of the folks that say captive bred are the ones that have the ones that don't burrow. I picked one up about 8 years ago now, that was, I walked into a pet store, there was a bunch of them, they were half dead, they got them from, I'm pretty sure they were wild caught, the guy wouldn't tell me where they came from specifically, I'm pretty certain they're wild caught. This one has been a burrowing machine, never gave up the burrowing. Now think about it. This is a spider that was probably plucked out of the wild, where it probably had a burrow, and it's used to burrowing, because why do spiders burrow? They burrow for security, but they also burrow so they can temperature regulate. That's how spiders regulate their temperature. They basically, and I wish I could find the paper, I have a link somewhere for it, where it talks about tarantulas basically thermoregulate by avoiding the extreme heat and extreme cold. They do that through burrows. The burrows maintain a temperature, I believe, I want to say it's high 60s, 67, 68 degrees. I know there's a paper on there about it, but that's important because that's what we would call our normal room temperature, and that's where a lot of these specimens spend the majority of their time, in those burrows, until either the sun goes down a bit, it becomes cooler outside, or at nighttime when it gets super cold, they'll retreat to the burrows, or in the wintertime, they'll retreat to the burrows. So that's how they temperature regulate. If it's too hot, they go in. If it's too cold, they go out. They can regulate by how far down they are in the burrow. So that's what this Asimani was used to weather, probably, where it was super hot. It could be cold at night where they come from. They use those burrows. So it continued to burrow, even though the temperature in my room never dips below 73 degrees. It's a great temperature for tarantulas, great temperature for spiders. It's still doing this behavior. Now, take the ones that have been raised in captivity. We provide our animals with good temperatures, with temperatures that they can thrive in at all times naturally. They don't have to worry about it dropping down to 50 degrees at night. It's usually not going to happen. They don't have to worry about it hitting 100 degrees. Most of us, we're not going to have 100 degrees in our tarantula room. So what's going to happen over a few life cycles of these animals? The first slings come out, maybe they do some burrowing. Second group come out after being raised in these conditions, they're going to adapt. Things have changed. They are no longer in this environment where they're having extreme heat and extreme cold. So what's going to happen over generations? Some of them are going to abandon that burrowing behavior. We have altered their behavior because they don't need to do it. This is why I've talked to people before about how some of the old world species that are fossorial in the wild will web up top. And we've had this discussion before, and we've all kind of wondered about, like, why do some people, I have a Fimbriatus, Coelobrachius fimbriatus that burrows. Somebody else may have a Coelobrachius fimbriatus that just does a little webbing up top. OBTs back in the day, a lot of burrowing. They do little burrows, do some webbing up top. Mine, the majority of which, of them, do not burrow at all. They just web. Why is that? Well, is it possible that over years of captive breeding, they've recognized, they've adapted to their new environments and recognized, hey, I don't have to worry about 120 degree temperatures anymore. I don't have to worry about the sun beating down and becoming desiccated and dying out. I don't have to burrow. So they start abandoning those behaviors, which is why I think a lot of us see such a variation in the behaviors of our spiders. We all call it personalities. Perhaps it's just certain spiders that are, I'm going to use this term, somebody's going to be upset with it, but for lack of a better term, it maybe evolved a bit to be more better adapted to life in captivity, to recognize those hardships, the floodings that they would have to construct burrows and seal them up for, the heat, the extreme cold, it doesn't exist anymore. After years of captive breeding, is it possible that they have just adapted to those new surroundings? Think about it. When we talk about room temperature, what do we always say room temperature is? About 68 degrees to about 75 degrees or so. Think about the burrows. Where do the tarantulas go when it's too hot? Into their burrows that are about 67, 68 degrees. Where do they go if they want to bask a little? I don't know what the ideal is. I mean, I think anything, if we're being realistic, they can go out in 80 degrees. They can go out in 85 degrees. And I think a lot of us, we have rooms that get hotter in the summer. So there we got the seasons in. They get that hotter stuff. But I will say that in the summertime, there's a point where it gets a little hot. and they don't necessarily come out to get that heat. They kind of hide in their burrows. When it gets super hot, they come out of their burrows. They're climbing the enclosures. It's not because they're like, oh, yay, it's hot. It's because they're trying to escape the heat, and it's not working in the burrows. They're in our houses. So that's something to consider. Have we, through decades of captive breeding, even through a few years, let's take species that have just come into the hobby. Some of these guys you hear early on, you hear it all the time. Watch Davis Species Panama. They first came in, they're dropping like flies. I had so many people tell me they were dying. Now people are having more success with them. Is that because we're getting better at the husbandry? Probably, we're probably improving husbandry. Or is it because they're becoming more hardy because the ones being born into captivity have to repeat it? So we have our first wild-caught pairs. We have the babies. A bunch of the babies are dropping off like flies. This happens all the time when we get new species in. People are like freaking out because they can't figure out the care for them. Like, how do we keep them? Do we keep them moist? Do we keep them this way? Mine died. Mine died mysteriously. Is it possible those are the ones that just aren't fit for captivity? And then think about it. Out of those ones that die off, this is human selection now, not natural selection. Out of the ones that die off, those are the ones that weren't fit for this new norm. The ones that live were better suited for captivity. So they grow up, they become mature males and females, we pair those. Now they've already adjusted a bit. And what's gonna happen with that next generation? Suddenly this next generation comes out, people are like, yeah, mine are doing great. I know what's going on, mine are doing much better. Next generation comes out, yeah, mine are great, these are hardy. It happens all the time. And I think a lot of times we look at it and we go, our husbandry, like in the case of C. cynopubescens, in the case of Caribbean versicolor, yes, we had to make adjustments in the husbandry. But I've seen other species everybody's keeping the exact same way they did when they first came out. They were dropping like flies. Now they're doing fine. We're going to continue to see that. My theory, the ones we are changing, which ones are surviving, we are influencing which ones survive. The ones that survive are better suited for this environment and no longer wild animals after a while. They have been domesticated, whether we meant to or not, whether we appreciate that we've done this or not. To bring up a couple more examples of spiders that it seems like we've had an impact on. Afanopelma calcotis. I've talked about my Afanopelma calcotis, Nikki, that I'm pretty sure, not positive, but I'm pretty darn sure she was caught in the wild. She was wild caught. When I first got her, for the first 3 years I had her, every winter, every fall, right around October, she would bury herself. Like clockwork, 3 years in a row, almost to the date, she'd bury herself. And to the date, she'd come out. And speaking to folks that lived in the area where this spider was likely collected from, they explained to me that's when the winter comes. That's when the temperatures drop. That's when this spider in nature would have burrowed down real deep, got into that level that doesn't freeze, got into that level that was 70 degrees, and waited out the winter. And she did this despite the fact that she was in a captive environment where the temperatures at that point, they dropped a little lower. And I do believe at that point in my tarantula room, I wasn't using extra heat. So it could drop to 68 degrees or so. Sometimes, rare times, 66, she would recognize the trigger. Winter has come. She would burrow and that would be it. Now, whenever I talk about this behavior or talk about the husbandry for a calcotis, people would come forward and go, oh, I bought one as a tiny sling and she, you know, burrowed a little bit as a sling, but now she's out in the open all the time. Mine's out in the open all the time. Again, we have a situation where likely after being captive bred for a bit and no longer having to contend with those cold winter months where they had the burrow, they abandoned the burrowing activity. They abandoned that behavior because it was no longer necessary for their survival. We have changed things. So I think that's another example of how we might have impacted this species and altered its behavior. I also think back in the day, we started this off talking about Gramostola rosea, the rose-haired tarantula, everybody's favorite starter tarantula. I love rose hairs. I absolutely love the Gramostola, the G. porteri form, whatever they're calling it now, the no-color form. Love them. But back in the day, the majority, if not all of the ones we were getting into the hobby were wild-caught specimens. And what is the Gramostola rosea infamous for? It's infamous for its long fast. And I read an article years ago talking about how in Chile, where they come from, they would have a winter season. And this is usually where they would fast. And when they were transplanted from Chile up to the U.S., different locations, the seasons, yeah, sure, the room is heated all year long. They don't have a drop in temperature, but they still went by that internal calendar they had, or they recognized some trigger in the environment. The air got drier because the heat's kicking on. They could sense that it's getting a little cooler and they'd stop eating for long periods of time. I've even seen it back in the day with Homeoma chilense, which used to be the, what was it, Eulathus species red, and they were importing them again from Chile, and mine, I had adult females, or probably older adult females, would stop eating in the wintertime, wouldn't eat at all, start eating again in the spring. As we've bred these out more and more, more captive bred, people are actually can't import from Chile anymore, so people are forced, thankfully, to start pairing these and breeding the Gramostola rosea. What are we seeing? I've raised now three slings, and I've never had a problem with them fasting. Sure, they eat, they go into long premolt periods, but we're not talking about the fasting out of nowhere. They're nice and fat, and they stop eating. Is that behavior gone now? Are we still seeing that? I haven't heard the people that are talking about their specimens fasting are ones that have still some of those older captive or wild-caught females that work their way into the hobby. So again, another indicator of a way we might have somehow impacted these animals and changed them. I think that one thing that impresses the majority of us about tarantulas and spiders in general, they've been around for millions of years, and they are incredibly adaptable and hardy. And the adaptable part is the fact, is the piece that I think sometimes we overlook, because we as keepers want to give our spider the best environment possible. And I do think that involves researching where they came from, looking at those high temps, but looking at those low temps, looking at the fact that they burrow, because then again, we're talking about the fact that they're used to temperatures in that, you know, high 60s, low 70s range. Do they come out and obviously get some heat? Yes. And I think a lot of us, our tarantula rooms, they naturally have a day-night cycle where they come out and get some heat. I think all that stuff's good. I am not in any way, shape, or form telling people they should not look at the natural history of their spiders. Absolutely not. I do it with every single spider I get. I read up on it. But I do think with the adaptability part is the part that we really need to take a look at, because they are so adaptable, they don't just survive, or I've heard the word tolerate use, as in our collections, at our homes, at these temperatures, in these enclosures. That's not what they're doing. They are thriving. We know very well what it looks like when a particular species doesn't thrive in captivity. There are many deaths of this species. They don't reproduce. They don't burrow. They don't web. They're lethargic. They don't eat well. They have molt issues. They die off. They're not doing well in captivity. They're not thriving. We have ones that just, you know, situations where people get them, like, this thing eats here and there. It doesn't look very happy. It hasn't webbed. It looks insecure. That's an instance where a species is just tolerating captivity. However, we have spiders that are thriving. How do we know that they're thriving? They're active. They eat well. They web. They create their burrows. Most importantly, they breed. They reproduce slings. They have sacks of healthy slings where the majority of the slings live. If the conditions weren't conducive, if the conditions weren't the spider thriving, they would not be producing at that level. We would have problems with the slings dying. We would have problems with them not being very hardy. That's not what we're seeing. I've raised, and I want to point out the Caribbean versicolor. When I raised my Caribbean versicolor, my sack of slings, I believe I paired her in November, December. So she was bred in the winter when the temperatures in my tarantula room at that point were high 60s, low 70s. She was paired. She had a healthy egg sac with about 100 slings in it. They all did well. I raised up several of those slings in those temperatures. They all did well. And this is considered to be a finicky species. So what does that tell you? That tells you that, is that because my care is so super great? No, it shows me that somewhere along the line, they've become more adaptable to life in captivity. They are thriving it. They reproduce in what in the wild would be like, if you were to take a wild caught specimen and do this, I don't know if it would do the same thing, but I think as hobbyists, we have to start recognizing that we're not dealing with wild animals anymore. We're not, in most cases, we're not dealing with animals that have the same requirements they would have had they grown up and survived in a wild environment, in their natural environment, with all of the things with heat, cold, flooding, starvation, predation. We've taken all of that out. And back to our definition of domestication, we said the active management of fitness of the domesticate by the domesticator ensures provision of resources and or services by the former to the latter, resulting in increased fitness of both interacting partners. So increased fitness in terms of spiders, increased fitness to captivity, perhaps. I would think would be foolish not to consider this as a possibility, which is something. Why do we bring this up? What is the point of this? I think as a hobby, we have to start recognizing this, because I think a lot of us, we get into these spiders, and all we want is to give them the absolute best care we can. And as I did a podcast earlier, how looking into their natural environments can be both great and can be a detriment, because if we go too far into the natural environment, too far trying to recreate that, we can cause problems. Why is that? Because if we're trying to set up a truly natural environment for a spider that has spent generations being bred in captivity, that is not the same spider that's in the environment that we're talking about. That is not the same spider that is the wild species that we're trying to emulate this thing for. And I think that's a very important thing to note. This isn't something where we're pulling them out of the wild and trying to recreate their homes to make sure they survive in our homes. We are talking about the, whether we meant to or not, the domestication of these spiders. The fact that we have controlled the resources, we have controlled the breeding, we have controlled which ones live, which in many cases is all of them. Because think about it, these sacs, we don't have a lot of heavy losses anymore with the majority of these guys, especially the ones that have been in the hobby for a while. They're all getting out there. They have adapted. They are thriving in captivity the way we are keeping them now. There's a reason why when you look back into the 80s and 90s that there was a lot more focus on providing heat, providing all these different things for them, because we were pulling them out of the wild, pulling them into our homes where they weren't used to. You have a spider that's living in temperatures where it can get up to 80, 90 degrees, and suddenly they're in our living room at 65. That's a shock to them. They're not used to that. However, down the road, that thing produces. Say they produce, they get babies. Those babies have now grown up and thrived and survived. We'll say survived. How's that? I'll hand it to the people that are worried about this. They survived an environment that was not, did not represent where they normally would have grown up, did not represent what it supposedly would have been, the conditions they would have grown up in. They survived in it. They reproduce. What happens to that next group? They're even more fit to survive in it. We are changing them as we go. And I would love to see some research into this. I would love to have people. I'm willing to guess, have there been physiological differences? Again, I look back at how many species came into this hobby that we said, you need to keep them moist. You need to keep them moist as adults. They won't thrive otherwise. We get them in our collections. They do just fine nowadays. Is that because we've changed our care, or because the spiders have grown up, evolved a bit, for lack of a better term, to be better adapted to life in captivity? These spiders that we are raising are captive bred. They are raised in captivity. They are meant to be in captivity. They are not wild animals. And trying to go over the top to recreate these environments for them with things they would have in the wild doesn't make a lot of sense to me, because it's not what they require. And for people who want to say that they're just surviving in these conditions, I totally disagree. They are thriving. We are breeding. We've been doing this for decades now. We've evolved our care over the years, and I think we've evolved our care in a way that kind of mirrors how these animals have changed, how they become more adapted to a life in captivity, to a life where they are free from the dangers. Why are they adjusting the way they behave? Well, because a lot of the things that could cause them death in their natural environments no longer exist, and they haven't had to contend with it for generations. So I think that's always something important to consider. And kind of what brought this on is I had two different contacts with somebody. One person was doing the old, they don't have water dishes in the wild, why are you using them? And I hate that argument, because guys, this isn't the wild. These guys, we make things so much more agreeable to them. They are so much easier for them to survive in captivity than the wild. It's crazy. And in the wild, they're not kept in little glass cages. In the wild, they're not fed consistently. In the wild, we don't have somebody sitting there going, oh, the substrate's a little dry. They would just go through a drought in the wild. No, we make sure they've got everything they need. So that's a ridiculous, you know, like I said, in the wild, dogs came from wolves. In the wild, wolves hunt. Should we throw our dogs out in the woods and not let them come in until they hunt and kill a rabbit or something? That's stupid. This is not the same thing. And I also had somebody else contact me that was upset because I didn't set up my enclosures in a more naturalistic setting. The heat thing came up and they're like, why don't you do this and that? And I was trying to explain to the person that that's great for a species that is in the wild, but it's not what we're dealing with here. We have changed the rules. We have changed the parameters over decades. And I think the spiders have risen to, again, you don't survive for millions of years by accident. You're adaptable. You're able to adapt the situation. We're looking at things with certain species of spiders now. Speaking of adaptability, just being able, we're talking about Piscelotheria with somebody who lives in an area where they get Piscelotheria species around their home. They've come into urban environments. They're trying to adapt to man coming in. That's not normally how they live, but this is where they're living now. You hear all this talk about the Juro spiders in the U.S. and how they're coming in. They were down south. They've transplanted over from, I believe, Japan, and now they're working their way up the East Coast, and they're saying at some point, these guys, as they're getting up colder and colder, there's like a line we have in the U.S. where there's a certain point where it freezes in the winter, animals can't survive. There's speculation that they will eventually get to the point where they'll be adapt to the point where they'll be up to these areas where it freezes, and they could be as far north as where we are. And I hope they get up here. I'm kind of dying to see them, quite frankly. But spiders in general, just very hardy, adaptable. Now, hardy means you can survive in crappy conditions. Let's call it out as it is. Adaptable means you change to thrive in those conditions. And that's what I've seen with my spiders. I think that's what we're all seeing as this hobby grows and expands, and we expand the captive bred breeding and we get more and more generations of captive bred animals. I know we'd love to say our husbandry is getting better, and I do think it's getting better. I do think we've hit a point where we kind of really understand how to best keep these guys. We don't have to dip back into things we did in the 80s and 90s with the heat lamps and everything else. We know how they thrive, they breed. And I think that anybody that says, well, you know, they're wild animals. No, they're no longer, the majority of these guys are no longer wild animals. I think that's a mischaracterization. We are not dealing, we have just, unless we're going to say these animals are completely immune to human domestication, we have to concede that over time, over decades, we have in many ways domesticated tarantulas. Notice I'm not saying they're tame. That's not the scientific definition that we're using here. We're talking about we have raised them. We have actively managed their fitness. We have changed them. And as a result, we have the resources, which again, money is the root of it. We are able to sell them in the hobby, get more people interested in the hobby. More people are buying them. I think that's something we need to start considering and talking about. Now, again, I know when I toyed with putting this one out, and I'm glad I waited because I've done more research as we've gone and more thinking about it, have more, you know, examples, but I know this is going to be one of those things that people are going to, some people will probably freak out about. I just think the evidence is there. If you look at everything else that humans have touched, fish, for crying out loud, we see it with fish. It's not inconceivable that we have domesticated many of these animals and will continue to do so. So I think we need to be really careful when we start trying to overdo it as far as recreating their natural environments, because I think in many ways we have given them an ideal environment to survive, as evidenced by how many of these guys survive as slings and make it into the hobby to go on to other keepers who are going to grow them up and breed them and enjoy them. And as a final thought, to be very, very, very clear so nobody misses my point, I am not telling you to ignore the natural habitats of your spiders. That is not the point of this at all. The idea is to reframe our thinking a little bit to recognize that we're not dealing with mild animals anymore, and that the direct application of things that they have in the wild, it just doesn't fit this scenario. It's not the same scenario. If we were trying to raise captive, and this is the way I would look at it, if I was pulling something out of the wild to raise it, to release it back into the wild, absolutely it would be crucial to make sure that we don't accidentally or inadvertently domesticate these animals. 100%. And I think people that work in the business of doing this, of taking animals in, raising them for redistribution into the wild, this is important. This is important. You have to follow these rules. You have to make sure we are creating all of this stuff to make sure this spider is ready to go back into its natural environment. That's not what we're talking about here. This spider isn't going into the natural environment. That's not what we're doing in our homes. It's not what they're going to have. They're not going to have that anymore. So we're looking for the spiders to be more adaptable to our own homes, to captivity. So I am not telling people not to look up where they're going from. I'm not telling you that you should not give them room to dig. I'm not telling you that you should not make sure that they have correct temperatures. I'm not telling you that you shouldn't make sure that they have access to moisture, that they have the moist substrate to keep their book lungs moist from losing too much. I'm not saying any of that. What I'm saying is we have to start reframing how we think and recognizing that as this hobby grows, as we get more and more people interested, as more and more of these animals, these species are established in the hobby, that the ones we keep in our home are not wild animals any longer. So that will do it for this one. I hope people, in the very least, I hope I gave folks some food for thought. I would love to hear feedback from folks, you know, folks in the scientific community. Have there been studies on this? Has anybody looked at it? I would love, I don't know if this will ever happen, but I would love to see somebody study the wild caught specimens and some that have been in the hobby for decades to see if there's any physiological differences. Are there, have the cuticles thickened? Or is there a difference in the operation of the book lungs, a spermatheca change, whatever it may be? Have there been physiological changes? Because I'm going to go out on a limb and say there probably have been. These animals, as they continue on through the captivity, I'm assuming things change. We've seen behavioral differences. It wouldn't shock me if there were physiological differences. I'm just not sure if there have been any studies on it, but man, would I love to see some. So if somebody out there is looking for some type of study to do, that would be amazing. And I'd love to hear, if there was something done, I'd love to hear about it. I did look up a bunch of studies on different things like this. I even looked up about the domestication of insects, obviously not the same, arachnids, insects, but again, an animal that we have changed, animals that we have changed and altered through just interaction and keeping them and maintaining them. I'd love to hear feedback on this one. Again, it's food for thought. It's something that I hope there's more discussions of moving ahead to recognize the difference, because I do think it's important to make that distinction. Not in the case of ones that are freshly introduced to the hobby. I think that's the best place, and I want this said loud and clear. For new species, you absolutely need to look at where they're coming from, what they're used to, what their climate is, and try to replicate that as best we can. For wild-caught specimens, same thing. You want to be a little more attentive to where they come from, because there may be some, for lack of a better term, shock when they're moved from one environment to the other. But I think for the majority of these ones that are being raised as slings and brought into the hobby, we know how it works now. We keep them. We breed them. They thrive. They don't just survive. They thrive. And this is from years and years, decades of experience of people working with and breeding these animals. So that will do it for this one. As always, you can find me on YouTube. You can find me on TomSpeakSpiders.com. You can find me on Tom Speaks Spiders Podcast. YouTube, I just posted up a video. I got the box in from Fear Not, which had the velvet spiders in it. So everyone that freaked out over the YouTube video that was made where somebody selectively took clips out of my podcast and didn't play the whole thing, of course, because that's how we do things. We clip things so we can create our own narrative and cause a bunch of drama. I love the velvet spiders. I did a podcast on velvet spiders, on their care. The whole point of the podcast was to mention the pros and cons of why they are so popular, and I think I put that across pretty well, and to explain how I was a ding-dong for ignoring them for so long. But of course, that was lost in translation when people were able to pull pieces from it. So hopefully people will see this and go, hey, apparently he doesn't think they ruined the hobby because he just got three more. I love them. They're awesome. And I've been telling other people. The nice thing is, now that I'm keeping them, some other people come forward and say, hey, I thought the same exact thing, but now that I've seen you have them, I might give them a shot, which is awesome, which was what I was looking for. The whole point was to show that being a contrarian, and I wasn't a complete contrarian, I just wasn't completely interested in them because I was seeing them everywhere, but I realized the error of my ways. So hopefully that comes through in this video. Also, I got my Lephistia species in that I've been waiting to get some of these guys. I have those set up. You can see those beautiful spiders. And I got another Scolopendra galapagensis, so I look forward. I didn't show that a lot in the video because I already did a whole thing on it and showed it off, but I did get another one of those. So some really cool stuff. Again, as I said before, it's always been Tom's Big Spiders, not Tom's Tarantulas, because of the fact that I did know at some point I'd probably branch out, and here we are. I'm trying to branch out more. My goal, I made a list the other day. Actually, it took me a few days of all of the species of tarantulas and spiders I kept, and I was shocked to find up were around 180, which I was, either some of them I still have, so I wouldn't say I've successfully kept them yet. You know my thoughts on that. I want to grow them up first, but I've kept 180 different species, which kind of blew my mind. So very excited to do 180 more, hopefully. So that will do it for this one. As always, guys, stay safe. Please feel free to chime in if you want. I would love to hear back from you guys. This is one of those, and again, final thing, because I'm always so worried. I can't help it because it's happened to me twice now where people have just cut stuff out of podcasts and people don't bother to listen to it. Please recognize all of this is just a theory I have. There is no proof. It's an opinion. I think there's a lot of good evidence for this happening. I've tried to give some examples of it, but it's just a theory. So please don't run around saying Tom Moran says this is an absolute fact. It's not. That's why I'm beckoning people to do some research on this. Experimentation, whatever needs to be done to kind of prove it. I would love to see some of that information. But anyway, guys, that'll do it for me. Stay safe. Catch you all next time.